care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're back, we're dads on the air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air, October 2010. And we've got a great program today. We'll be speaking with, first up, with Warren Farrell. Dr. Warren Farrell is a professor who has taught in the School of Medicine at the University of California at San Diego. He's taught psychology, women's studies, political science, and sociology at Georgetown, Rutgers, and Brooklyn College. And he'll be speaking to us in connection with the forthcoming International Men's Day on November 19. And then later on, we'll be speaking with Leanne Smith from the HALO Group in Western Australia. Leanne Smith is the founder of HALO and the CEO. And HALO is a not-for-profit community-based agency that works with young people, mainly Aboriginal young people. And HALO stands for Hopes, Aspirations, and Leadership Opportunities. And it'll be great to speak to Leanne. So on this bright, sunny Sydney day, this is Bill Cable from Mediate Now, and in the studio with me is Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com.
Yes, good morning, Bill. Good morning, Phil, and good morning, listeners.
And also we've got Phil York from Dads in Distress.
G'day, everyone.
So as we lead up towards International Men's Day, which is on November 19, we'll be featuring a number of articles and a number of people we'll be speaking to, thanks to Jason Thompson from the Movember group. The International Men's Day in Movember started out as separate events, but they are now becoming intertwined events, and it's all leading to making November a men's month. For instance, groups observing Movember in Italy, Spain, Britain, France and Netherlands are holding special events this year on International Men's Day, November 19, to award those with the best moustache or to raise money for the Movember charity. In the Netherlands, they are holding an art auction for International Men's Day with proceeds going to the Movember Fund for Prostate Cancer. There are a number of events going on around the world for International Men's Day, and we'll be featuring interviews around the world on as we get closer to November 19. So that's something to look forward to. We'll also next week be speaking to Rob Trahan, and he'll be talking about Movember, which is really starting to get some momentum in Australia and around the world. I know I'll be starting my moustache as soon as we get to the end of October. So lucky we don't have a video radio. In any event, raising in Australia, the funds being raised with the Movember's men's health movement are going to be Beyond Blue, the National Depression Initiative, the Prostate Cancer Foundation of Australia, and the Movember Foundation. So for people who want to register and want to start growing those moustaches, I'll refer you to the website. It's www.movember, that's M for Molly, O-V-E-M-B-E-R.com, www.movember.com, and you can register there for Movember and start growing those moustaches and make that statement. This is an area where help is desperately needed. When you consider in Australia there'll be close to 3,300 deaths as a result of prostate cancer this year, many of which would have been preventable with early detection, added to which one in eight men will experience depression in their lifetime, and most of those people will not seek help. So they're both silent illnesses. Phil York is with me from Dads in Distress, and I think he's seen enough of certainly of the depression that that a lot of men go through.
Absolutely. Thanks, Bill, for mentioning that. And yeah, very true. And as Bill said, I'll just say again, Beyond Blue do a wonderful job. So anyone can get onto this wonderful campaign and help out Beyond Blue, and obviously help out the community at the same time would be fantastic.
There's a good news story in connection with male depression recently, and that's to do with the Australian swimmer, the swimming comeback king, Jeff Hugel. people might have been following his spectacular success at the Commonwealth Games when he won gold in the 100-metre butterfly, but may not be aware that during that period when he wasn't swimming, he got into a very deep depression. He was taking antidepressants on and off for 6 years, and he felt personally about himself that he was just a glorified promotional model, even when he was at the peak of his swimming career. So he started getting that feeling of worthlessness, and after 2004, the illness hit him even harder. His reaction to all this was to start partying hard, boozing and eating junk food, and I think everyone knows that he put on something like 45 kilos during that period, all of which had to come off if he was going to get his life back together again. Hugel is now the face of Black Dog Institute's Exercise Your Mood campaign, which encourages people to improve their mood with endorphin-releasing exercise. And Jeff participated in a fundraising swim yesterday at the Botany Aquatic Centre alongside fellow swimmers Libby Trickett, Kai Hurst, Brendan Capel and Samantha Marshall. Jeff said that the hardest part is realising that you have this problem and accepting that you are in a state and you need help. But once you realise that you do have a problem, it's easy to get help from there. And he's promoting the Beyond Blue Institute, which for people who feel they may be at risk with this, there's the Black Dog Institute, there's Beyond Blue, there's Dads in Distress. There are a number of people out there who are able to help when you get into if you have those difficulties. So that's a good story. Remember, Movember is starting in about a week's time, the 1st of November, and that's when we'd like to see all those men out there starting to look a bit silly maybe, but to start growing those moustaches. On the other hand, there are people who say that a moustache makes you look very
sinister and
hairy.
Or gay.
There are those who say, well-maintained moustache is a symbol of the modern gentleman, a coat of arms on the face of a man who is always infallibly and with honour dedicated to the cause of chivalry, sound judgment and grooming. So not sure which of those categories you'll fall into if you start growing your moustache, but let's all get behind it. It's going to be a great campaign for Movember in 2010. Now, Ian, have you got something for us there?
Well, I've got a couple of things. There was one here. We'll just get this one. This is a bit of a shocker. Pill stats tough to swallow. Article appeared in Sunday Telegraph. Caroline Marcus has written, paracetamol poisonings in children aged under 3 have hit a record high in New South Wales. Phone calls to the New South Wales Poisons Information Centre about the common household drug have more than doubled compared with 4 years ago, and infants were most at risk. Of calls relating to children, 11% resulted in hospitalisation, a 1% increase from the previous year, while 21% required medical treatment. More than 4 in 5 calls about children related to infants aged under 3 years of age. The rise in poisonings moved New South Wales Health Minister Carmel Tebbit to issue a warning to parents to keep medicines safely out of reach. Most accidental poisonings involving children 3 years and under, with 2-year-olds most at risk, she said. So keep the pills away from the kiddies. Apparently the next biggest problem was with Valium. So if you've got any medications, people, keep them well away from your kids, because if the kids see you taking it and think, oh yeah, that's a nice lolly, and then they take a couple, and next thing, they're dead.
Yep, I think the direct action there, keep them out of reach, so because they're going to have that attraction if they see others doing this. You just don't want kids taking unknown pills. And
you are their role model, and if they see you doing it, you know, they want to be a grown-up, well, they emulate grown-up behaviour, taking pills.
Yeah, now another item in the news, and this one we go over to India, where you can often see the same problems arising around the world in many of the areas that we talk about in this show. But in India, they've recently introduced a Domestic Violence Act. It's called the PWDVA, and 3 NGOs, non-government organisations, have come under the one fold to hold a protest. The protest was actually held on October 23, a couple of days ago, so we'll try and get some more information on how it turned out. But the NGOs were the Save Indian Family Foundation, the SIFF, Children's Rights Initiative for Shared Parenting, CRISP, and the All India Mothers-in-Law Protection Forum, AIMPF. And they held this Dharma, as they call it, on October 23 in front of the Gandhi statue in Bangalore. The Protection of Women Against Domestic Violence Act is has been summarised as being totally unconstitutional and violates basic human rights. It's a tool misused by cosmopolitan and misguided wives to avenge against the husband and the in-laws if their demands are not filled. The NGOs say that the new Domestic Violence Act is anti-child, anti-family, anti-woman and anti-man, and is a serious threat to society and Indian family values. It sounds very similar to some of the domestic violences that we've seen, changes that we've seen in Australia, some of the laws, particularly in Victoria, but it's starting to spread around Australia. And the demands that are being made in India are that this law should be repealed because it doesn't provide protection for men and children under this new act. It doesn't promote prosecution when there are false cases of domestic violence raised, and it doesn't separate maintenance laws from the domestic violence laws. They also call for a men's welfare ministry and a child welfare ministry. These are a lot of the things that have been argued for in Australia for a long time, and it's interesting to see that the fight's going on in India. And so it's even not just Western countries. It's actually seems to be a worldwide trend that people are going too far with this domestic violence and limiting it to just man against woman instead of all the forms of domestic violence that we're against. So let's hope that these groups in India have some success, and maybe it'll start the ball rolling, and we'll see other improvements occur in other parts of the world. So
I've got another one here. This is a couple of articles. This is something that's happened in Sydney. Pervert policy protest. This article occurred in last Thursday's Telegraph. Vicky Campion and Jeff Chambers have written, schoolboys have been banned from a pool change room because adult male swimmers fear they would be falsely labelled pedophiles. Angry parents described the decision as political correctness gone mad after boys were forced to sit in wet swimmers on the bus back to school from Hornsby Aquatic Centre. We have actually an opinion piece by Sarah Lamarck-Hand, who is not usually that man-friendly, but I've got to say this piece she wrote in the Telegraph is very sensible. She writes, Sarah Lamarck-Hand writes, Hornsby Shire Council's decision to ban schoolboys from using a pool changing room to protect male swimmers from accusations of paedophilia is not only a victory for stupidity, but for cowardice. The council intervened last week following complaints from fellow pool goers who felt uneasy about changing in front of school students. The boys were unsupervised and the members of the public felt uncomfortable changing in front of the boys, a council spokesman told the Daily Telegraph. One stated that he had an untrue allegation made against him several years ago in a similar environment. The importance of this heightened vigilance towards child protection in recent years cannot be overstated. However, we cannot allow half the human race to be tainted by the actions of a reprehensible few. Men capable of committing child sex offences are not representative of the majority. Statistics confirm a child is more likely to be abused by someone they know and trust than by a stranger, yet we remain defined by anxieties of a predator lurking in the change room of the local pool. While it's the responsibility of every parent to take sensible precautions to minimise the risk of a child being targeted by a paedophile, that's not all we should be afraid of. If we continue to pander to our worst assumptions, an entire generation of men will be demonised. It's a shadow that will be cast for years to come. Council regulations prohibiting the presence of schoolboys and adults in a change room isn't only an insult to every grown man, it also sends a dangerous message to the pupils. Just as young people are warned of the sinister realities of the world, they must also learn to adapt to varying circumstances. Sheltering them from an environment on the sole basis that something could go wrong is both unwise and unsustainable. But even more disturbing, the council ban reinforces the stigma of adult men being in the company of younger men. And then we complain about the lack of male role models available to teenagers. It's a women most, sorry, it's a right most women take for granted. She finishes the article by saying, "We have long passed the point of naively assuming there aren't people who will seize the opportunity to exploit a child's trust in the most horrific of ways. But we have gone too far. It is time to separate concern from paranoia and acknowledge the fundamental right of decent men not to be confused with predators." Hear, hear. I think we've all felt that one before. You know, when a little girl comes and sits on your knee, some of the people in the room look at you like, "What's that little girl doing sitting on your knee? Are you, what are you doing?" You know, and it's just completely wrong, you know, when all you want to do is show affection and smile at her and whatever, in an innocent, normal, healthy way. Yeah, the stigma must go.
Yes, I think there are extremes here, and when you think of all the good work done, for instance, in the scouting movement, Whereas there seems to be a bit of a stigma growing now about scoutmasters because of the odd incidents that's been reported over the years. So it's a pity when these things get to that stage.
I mean, the priests, you know, priests have also led to this. I mean, you know, every denomination on every continent has a pedophile problem in every religious sect. I mean, pedophile priests, these are, you know, the people who our children must be protected against. But spilling this concern out into the general community is unwise, and it has serious consequences.
Okay, well, we might go to a short break now, and then we'll be back with our interview with Dr. Warren Farrell.
All I need is a woman to be good to me. I'm an easy man, I'm easily pleased. And you provide me with everything that I need. Look, you know I make ends, I grind. So hold on to yours, we're spending mine. Though you try, never let you buy. But if I was broke, would you still be spending time?
Yes.
And I believe you would. Don't think peace to treat you good. I walk street with you,
yes.
Talk deep with you,
yes.
Even sleep and spend all week with you. Then I'm off. You wish I put an end to the torment. Stop, but one thing is not ever as boring. What would you rather me be like? I ain't never gonna change. Are you ever gonna realize? Look, people are always gonna talk, bitch.
Accusation.
I ain't even gonna laugh, but it ain't like you don't know what mine is.
I don't care what you do to your life.
Nah.
Just be good to me.
Try. Look, babe, you know I am, but as crooked as I am, I'll be as good as I can. I try and try, though it's evident my angel face is disguised for the devil inside. You're good to me, I ain't good to girls. Me, I'm a bad boy, something every good girl needs. Hey, honestly, could avoid all your tantrums, but I'm a naughty boy and I always have been.
What?
And that ain't changing anytime soon. I can't have you with me whenever I move. Whatever I do, I come back to you. See, the good attracts me and the crook attracts you.
What is the boys talk about?
Look, people are always gonna talk, bitch.
Accusation.
I ain't even gonna laugh, but it ain't like you don't know what mine is.
I don't care what you do to them.
Nah.
Just be good to me.
I'm not gonna treat you better.
I don't care what you do to them.
No, no.
Just be good to me.
I'll try.
Yeah.
November 19th, International Men's Day, is a global occasion to celebrate the positive contributions and diverse experiences of being male. On this day, we highlight those inspirational men and boys who helped to forge a better world and who show by example how to live with self-respect and integrity in their relationships with other people and with the world around them. On this day, we celebrate men's and boys' strengths while taking time to acknowledge their vulnerabilities and needs. We aim to transcend negative stereotyping and encourage greater options and choices for men and indeed for all people. Finally, it's a day for all humanity, providing an opportunity to consider the vast arena of human experience shared by men, women and children alike. Our similarities deserve to be celebrated, as do our differences. With this inclusive vision, International Men's Day seeks to bring a new and healing spirit to the world. On this International Men's Day 2010, we have the great pleasure of talking with Dr. Warren Farrell from his office in Mill Valley, California. Dr. Farrell began his research on gender issues in the 1960s. His first book, The Liberated Man, was published in 1974. It was written from women's and feminist perspectives. By the 1980s, Warren began noticing that men were feeling misrepresented, and his book, Why Men Are the Way They Are, was written to answer women's questions about men in a way that rings true for men. By the 1990s, Dr. Farrell felt the misunderstandings about men had deepened and become dangerous to the survival of families and love. He confronted the misunderstandings head-on with the award-winning book, The Myth of Male Power. Dr. Farrell's most recent research is published as Why Men Earn More, The Startling Truth Behind the Pay Gap and What Women Can Do About It. Warren, it's great to speak with you today about International Men's Day.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be with you too, Greg.
Look, I might start by dealing with a common misperception about International Men's Day. Often when I mention International Men's Day to people who don't work in the field of gender and men and women, the response I get is, but isn't every other day International Men's Day? Aren't gender inequalities taken for granted? Aren't the achievements of the privileged men who lead us in politics and culture, aren't they celebrated all the time? And aren't women's lives and concerns regularly trivialised and marginalised? Why do we need to celebrate International Men's Day when men still rule the world? That's the sort of attitude that I often get. What are your thoughts on this, Warren?
Yeah, it's really a very good question to lead off with, because that's the fundamental misunderstanding that leads to a lack of empathy for men. And basically what the world was about until recently was about survival. And what we've done in the last 30 years is not, we've sort of forgotten that and said, well, it's men who had the power, men who made the rules. Men made the rules to benefit men at the expense of women. And so therefore, in that, if you believe that, then that does appear to be true, because after all, most of the governments are run by men and most of the top corporations are run by men. So the overt manifestation of that appears to be almost self-evident. And so, but here's the flaw in that thinking, that throughout all of history, it was not men who ruled. It was the need to survive that ruled and controlled. And men and women try to play different roles that led both of them to be disposable in that need to survive. Women had to risk their lives in childbirth to bear children. If they didn't do that, they didn't have the choice to do that or not to do that. Theoretically, they had the choice, but practically speaking, their parents, their families, their communities, their churches, their synagogues, their whatever, all told them they'd get more love, affection, approval, and they'd be more like a woman, like a real woman, if they found a man, raised children most of their lives. Men, conversely, learned the parallel to that, which is, it's not your job to raise children, it's your job to raise money so that children can be raised effectively. So women's job, raise children, men's job, raise money. Both of those were not rights, they were obligations, they were responsibilities. They were what you did to become a go from girl to woman. They were what you did to go from boy to man. The male version of the male aspect of that disposability was that every society that survived throughout history survived based on its ability to persuade its boys that the way that they became men is to risk disposability. to risk disposability in war, to risk disposability in Chilean coal mines, to risk disposability in British petroleum oil rigs, to risk disposability as a lumberjack, as an Alaskan fisherman doing something dangerous in Australia. Whatever is hazardous to the health of the man, the man was expected to do. But why was the man expected to do that? Because what it took to create a healthy society created an unhealthy man. That is, what it took to create a healthy society was to be able to defend that society against invaders. Whether it was Aborigines or Native Americans, they couldn't defend their society against invaders. That group of people got taken over. And the people that were the oppressors, if you will, we were the ones that were able to conquer, and we had to be able then to defend what we conquered, or we would be taken over. So who was asked to do that? Men were asked to do that. And the United States is still today the male, the 18-year-old boy who is obligated to register for the draft. No 18-year-old girl is obligated to register for anything. Girls have become the only group of people who have the privilege of voting without any obligation attached to that privilege. And so in many respects, the assumptions of male disposability, the requirements of male disposability, were that the legal obligations to register for the draft, or the expectation that if you're a working class man, you're going to work in that coal mine or do something that you can to support the family. Those obligations were not called obligations. They were called power. And that's what misled us, that led us to believe that men had the power and women didn't, as opposed to understanding that men had one set of obligations that we call power, and women had another set of obligations that we didn't call powerlessness, we called powerlessness, and that made it seem like the men were powerful and the women weren't. So, for example, men seem to, when boys begin to become men, we start thinking of girls' sexuality. And it seems from the girls' point of view that men have the option of, asking women out, and and do ask women out, and oftentimes the ones to rape women and date rape women. And so it clearly seems from the girls' point of view that men are powerful and oppressive and only after one thing, sex. But when we look closer, if we're the mother of a son or the father of a son, we see the enormous fear that the boy has in reaching out and experiencing rejection. He's expected at the age of 13 or 14 to risk rejection with girls about whom he knows nothing, and sexually about which he knows almost nothing. And the fears that he has of being rejected are understood by a mother and father watching the 13, 14, 15-year-old boy go through that process. But if you've forgotten about that, or you didn't have a brother that you cared for very much, and you were just tuned into maybe feminist ideology, which said men were oppressors, you started forgetting about those experiences and fears of rejection. And when no one had said to you, if you're a girl, why don't we just reverse this for a while? And why don't we have all girls who grow up be the ones who are expected to risk rejection and ask the boys out? And why don't we have boys' sexuality valued more than girls' sexuality, and boys' physical looks valued more than girls' physical looks? And so then girls would risk rejection to want sex that boys keep in short supply from them, and if they really want it badly enough, they should pay for it by asking the boys out on a date. So they should be involved in the double jeopardy of risking rejection, and then once they've overcome the rejection and gotten some permission to be asked out about something very shameful called sex, we will then have the woman pay for the privilege of being with the boy. Well, no group of women would get together and say, oh yes, we'll reverse roles with you, we'll take care of that, because or at least we'll share roles with you. We'll share not the option of asking boys out, but the expectation of asking boys out. And that's the big difference. So today, what we've created is an era internationally. We have two basic sets of societies, industrialized societies and non-industrialized societies. In industrialized societies, that's the societies where the roles have begun to change. But they've begun to change in the sense that in industrialized societies, there is the option of divorce, because the society can afford that. They cannot afford the option of divorce in non-industrialized societies. So in industrialized societies that have the option of divorce, men and women have, that's where once there is divorce, that women have begun to be much more assertive and much more, and creating options. And so in those societies, we've developed the era of the multi-option woman and the no-option man. And the most typical everyday multiple option that women have that men don't have is that when the woman is pregnant and she's married, oftentimes, and she's involved with her career, people will sit around the table and say, "Oh my God, you're pregnant, how wonderful." And then they'll start brainstorming the three options she has. Option one is to be full-time involved with the children. Option two is to be full-time involved with the workplace. Option three is to do some combination of both. And her husband sits around and says, option one is, you know, I can work full-time. Option two is I can work full-time. And option three is I can no work full-time. Or if he's a working class man, I can work two jobs. So we say that he has the power because he's now earning more money than that woman does when he's obligated to work full time. But, you know, when I got into a cab some years ago and a cab driver said to me, you know, what are you talking? I was in the cab with Gloria Steinem going to a radio show. And the cab driver said, "What are you guys talking about?" You know, because he knew we were going to a radio show. And we said, "We're talking about male power." And he goes, "You know, well, what do you mean by male power?" And I say, "Well, you know, the fact that men have more money and men have more power and influence." He says, "Well, who makes more money, me or my wife?" And I said, "Probably you do." And he said, "Yeah, I make more money than my wife, absolutely. She gets to stay home, take care of three children. I get out here on the streets of New York City working 70 hours a week. Do you think I'd rather be home with my children or working 70 hours a week in a job and trying to escape being in an accident in New York City?" Well, we got the point. And he said, "You guys must be from academia." So he had us figured out in 2 seconds.
He's a real nowhere man, sitting in his nowhere land, making all his nowhere plans for nobody. Doesn't have a point of view, knows not where he's going to. Isn't he a bit like you and me? Nowhere man, you don't know what you're missing. Nowhere man, the world is at your
grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dad's in Distress, 1300 853 437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
one of the objectives of International Men's Day is to improve gender relations and promote gender equality. You talk in your books about the need for a gender transition movement, and that's distinct from a separate women's movement or a men's movement. A lot of people may not have heard of this concept. What exactly do you mean by this gender transition movement?
Well, we understand that, like, when we talk to our grandparents about, you know, women's rights or men's rights, you know, the whole concept of rights, they just go, you know, they just, like, you know, it's sort of like it's anathema to them. Because from our grandmother's perspective and our grandfather's perspective, the world was not about rights. The world was about responsibilities and obligations. And so when you understand that both sexes, women had the obligation and the expectation to be more feminine by raising children, men had the obligation and expectation to be more masculine by risking their lives in war or risking their lives in work or raising money, basically. And so so if you have both sets of genders having roles, then what was not appropriate, it was not appropriate to have a women's movement liberating men without and condemning, liberating women and condemning men, or a men's movement liberating men and condemning women. It's appropriate to have a gender transition movement where we together make a transition from the old rigid gender roles to more fluid gender roles, where a man raising children can be as respected as a woman raising money. The good news is the women's movement has done some wonderful things for women. It has opened and freed women from the old strict gender roles, and it's taught women how to be able to not only raise children but also to raise money. And the good news about that is women have flexibility. But if you think of a family as also including men, brothers, sisters, and husbands, and then you think of the family boat, and we've changed the women's movement has helped women row on both sides of the boat, raise children or raise money, and men have only learned to row on one side of the boat, raise money. In a recession, we need the men to be able to be flexible enough to also raise children while the men, women perhaps raise money. And so what we've done is we've taught women to row on both sides of the boat, but taught men to row only on one side of the boat. And the problem is that when women exercise their power to row on the side where men can only row on, if men can only row on that side, the boat that is rowed on one side by both sexes is a boat that goes in circles. And a boat that goes in circles is very vulnerable to the rocks of recessions. And so we see a global recession now in which we have women in industrialized societies trained much more effectively to row on both sides of the boat. That's why we need a gender transition movement to help both sexes be able to row on both sides of the boat, so all families are much less vulnerable to recessions and depressions.
But I know that this
I've just become a new father myself. I've got a 3-week-old baby son, and
congratulations to the mother, of course.
And one of the themes of International Men's Day is celebrating men's contributions to childcare. And you wrote a book, Father and Child Reunion, in which you talked about some of the specific sorts of care that fathers tend to provide that children really need. Do you want to just talk about those things, the things that men do as dads that are really important to the health and the welfare and the educational welfare and the upbringing of children as well-rounded individuals?
Yes, first of all, let me just be clear about there's two areas here. One is outcomes, and the other one is why. I can share with you, and I will, what happens when children have fathers that are very involved. Those are outcomes. Really good data backs up that portion of Father and Child Reunion. I will then share with you some reasons why I believe that is the case. I believe you'll find those will make a lot of sense, but they can be argued with, because all reasons why can be argued
sure.
with. Okay, so the children do better in about 26 different areas of measurement when they have when fathers are more involved versus less involved. They do significantly better when children are raised primarily by their dads. They actually do better than children raised primarily by their moms. This does not mean, though, that men are better as fathers than women are as mothers. Because when people want to do something, when they self-select themselves to do something, they tend to have more motivation to do that and so on. It would be like a woman in the 1950s self-selecting to become a doctor. The chances are she would be a very good doctor, probably better than the average male doctor. And so for those types of reasons, children who are raised with significant father involvement are far less likely to get pregnant out of wedlock during teenage years. They're far more likely to get married and not be divorced. They're far more likely to do better in all academic areas, no exception, especially in their SATs, or the equivalent of the college admissions tests. I don't know if they're called SATs, and I'll show you.
Yeah.
They're far more likely to do better in all physical health areas. They're less likely to be sick from school. They're all the way to going to a hospital. They're far more likely to do better in social areas, like getting along better with other children, not getting into fights, not being bullies, and not being bullied. They're more likely to be liked by children, other peer group children, and be liked and respected by teachers and adults and other evaluators of their social skills. They're much more likely, and this is the most amazing thing, children raised with significant father involvement are significantly more likely to be empathetic. Now, this is the thing that most surprised me. And yet, study after study around the world that measured the impact of empathy and measurements of empathy show that children with significant father involvement are far more empathetic. Now, my bias in starting the research was that women, as a rule, tend to be more empathetic than men are. Mm-hmm. So how do you get more empathetic children when there's a significant father involvement? And the reason seems to be that most high school teachers see this. They have a very empathetic child in school that's really lovely, and then they meet the parents, and the parents might be an engineer or a tough love dad, or tough love parents, and but yet the child is very empathetic. Then you get a very self-centered narcissistic child, and you meet the parents on parent night, and you find these parents that are lovely, they're giving, they're empathetic. And what you start to understand is that empathy is not engendered by receiving empathy. Empathy is engendered by having to think of other people's needs. So if the father and the mother are requiring things of you, they're tough love dads, they're tough love moms, they're forcing you to think of somebody else other than yourself. If every time you do something, they're empathetic, no matter what you do, and even when you're not responsible, and do what you say you're going to do, then you don't have to become empathetic to anybody's needs and feelings but yourself. So you become self-centered and narcissistic, and that's why the teacher is so shocked to see this self-centered and narcissistic child. When they meet the parents, they were their favorite parents on parent night. And so that's just an example. Another example is the is that children who are raised significantly by dads are far more likely to be assertive, but much less likely to be aggressive. And so the social skills of children raised by both parents are significantly likely to be much better. And one of the reasons is that men tend to require things of their children. Women tend to empathize with their children and protect their children. And so, for example, when a father and a mother are both, and here's an example of why it's so valuable for a mom and dad to work together and to be home together and to be in an intact family if possible. Let's say the child in an intact family says, you know, "Mom or Dad, can I climb the tree in the backyard?" And the mom will be more likely to say, "Well, maybe, sweetie, in a few years it's kind of a dangerous tree, but in a few years, yes, but not right now." And Dad will say, "Oh, he or she is old enough to climb the tree. Don't worry about it. Don't baby the child." And the mom and dad get into an argument. And mom says, "You know, you're risking the child's life." And the father says, "You know, if the child doesn't learn how to take some risks and do things and watch out for himself, or you'll overprotect the child, and the child will never be able to be an adult." And so the fight goes on. But eventually that fight may resolve itself by something like the mother saying, "Okay, you can have the child climb the tree, but only the first three levels of branches, and not that branch over there because it's there. And you can't be out there with your cell phone. Here, I'll take the cell phone. You go out there, you make sure, when that cell phone rings, I'll make sure you're still, and you stand under the tree all the time and protect the child." Now, what's the child gotten? The child's gotten risk-taking skills. Risk-taking skills connect synapses that wouldn't otherwise connect, that increases IQ, that increases and changes shape and size of brain, we now know, and only from relatively recent research, that no father says to the mother, by helping that child take those risks, that child will have increased IQ, better development in that type of way. And the mother, at the same time, the child's gotten more protection as a result of the mother's involvement. And so the argument that comes between the mother and the father that may lead to a divorce because the father and mother each feel the other one is hopeless, was actually a functional argument. The argument was like the checks and balances of an Australian conservatives and liberal parties, you know, arguing against each other. So just like it takes two or multiple parties to run a government, it takes at least two parents with different points of view, and their tension, they have to understand that their tension is a tension that is meant to be, that it's checks and balances on each other's tendencies to overdo the tendency of men to say push, 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 and when you fail, get up and do it again without having time to empathize with and let the child cry, and the mother's tendency to say, "Well, if you fell off the chair, or you fell off the horse, or you fell off the ski on the ski slope, you don't ever have to ski again. You don't ever have to ride again if you don't want to."
Look, we're running out of time, Warren. Before you go, can you tell us a little bit about your recent work and thoughts, some of the projects you might be working on currently? You mentioned that you're working with a commission to create a White House Council on Boys to Men. You want to just tell us a little bit about that, and maybe if you're working on a new book or anything else that you're currently involved with?
Sure. I'm working with John Gray, the author of Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. He and I are working together on a book called Boys to Men. And then the White House Council, we're working on a proposal. I've created a commission of 30 thought leaders around the country to create a White House Council on Boys to Men. That proposal is being worked through many channels at both the White House and other places as we speak. And so that's, I have to sort of keep that under wraps for a while, but
sure.
Only of which is to say there is a White House Council on Women and Girls, and we're hoping that there will also be one that recognizes that instead of just caring about whales, we'll also care about males in the future.
Fantastic. Warren, it's been a great pleasure talking with you for International Men's Day 2010. Thank you so much for taking your time to share your thoughts with us, and all the best with your work for the future.
It's my privilege to be able to do so, and I really appreciate the enormous work and coordination of bringing awareness to boys and men's issues around the world. You're doing a great service, and a service to our sons and our and therefore to the global economy.
Thank you very much, Warren.
You're very welcome.
Oh, she may be weary. Them young girls, they do get wearied wearing that same old shaggy dress. Yeah, yeah. But when she gets weary, try a little tenderness. Yeah. You know she's waiting, just anticipating for things that she'll never, 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 never possess. Yeah, yeah. But while she's there waiting, and without them, try a little tenderness. Gotta do. It's not just sentimental, no, no, no. She has her grief and care. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But the soft words, they all spoke so gentle, yeah. It makes it easier, easier to bear, yeah. You won't regret it, no, no. Young girl, they don't forget it. Love is their whole happiness.
They grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air, this 26th day of October 2010. And our next guest is Leanne Smith, who is the founder and CEO of HALO. HALO is a community youth-owned and youth-driven agency advancing the hopes, aspirations and leadership opportunities, particularly of Aboriginal young men in Western Australia. Leanne, are you there?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for coming onto the show.
Oh, my pleasure.
Leanne, you've been getting a lot of media coverage lately, and I first became aware of you, I think, when I saw you on an episode of Can We Help back in June.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But, look, I was very impressed with the work you're doing, and just looking through some of this material there, I see you even went to the extent of selling your house to raise some money for this work, so you must be very committed to getting this all this good work done with the Aboriginal community over there.
Yeah, it seems so long ago that that all that happened now, and so much has happened since then. But it was certainly worth it.
Oh, well, that's great to hear. And perhaps could you tell us some of the work that you are doing and some of the success stories you've had?
Yeah, sure. Well, we mainly work with Aboriginal young men aged 14 to around 22 years of age, and most of them live in the city of Coburn, wider Fremantle region in Perth. Most of these young men come from, some pretty challenging backgrounds. But I think the thing for me that what I was seeing was that there was just so much hope. You know, they had dreams and goals and a lot of things that they really wanted to achieve amongst all that mess that was sort of going on. And so we decided to put a program together that was going to respond to that need and was going to do it in a way that they wanted to do it. So that's what's made it quite unique.
Yes, and I know the courts have embraced the opportunities that you raise for the young men, but it's no easy ride for them, is it? I mean, when you come and offer your services, they're expected to put an effort in.
That's right. It's a pretty tough program, really. I mean, for anybody that wants to embark on a personal development program's got to put the hard yards in. You can provide the space and the model and the workers, but you know, it doesn't matter whether you're trying to lose weight or trying to give up smoking or whatever it is, you've got to put the hard work in yourself. And for a young teenager to really look within and deal with some of those issues, that's a really tough journey, you know, to begin. And there's no shortcut or there's no easy way around that. So these young men, they're really very inspiring, and, I think it's sometimes it can be easier just to use drugs or hide away. So to make that choice that you want to make, you know, significant changes in your life, that's hard work.
Yes, and I believe you now use some of the people that have been through the program to encourage the next group of people coming through. So is it getting easier for you, do you think?
It is getting easier, yeah. Oh, absolutely. The boys that are coming through that have stepped up as peer support workers and youth workers are doing an incredible job now. We just finished a round of 15 workshops in the schools delivering leadership and cultural training with Aboriginal school-based trainees, and I didn't attend one of those workshops. Mm. So we had, you know, the three or four youth workers in those schools delivering the program, and I didn't accompany them on any of the workshops. The feedback was phenomenal. They really, you know, people just need an opportunity.
Yeah, look, that's wonderful, because it starts feeding on itself, doesn't it? Then people see those the people that have been through, they learn to admire them, and they might think that they could do the same thing.
Well, I think that really is the key element, and that's what makes the program different. It is, I'll be honest with you, it's a lot harder to take on trainees. It'd be a lot easier if we had two fully qualified youth workers that could do all the work that I can do, but we would not get the same results. So, you know, taking on trainees, putting young people through the program and then getting them to step up is really what works, although it's definitely a lot harder work from my end, but the rewards speak for themselves and the outcomes speak for themselves, because we're dealing with young men historically that, that come from families where nobody's ever had a job. So that intergenerational unemployment just perpetuates itself. And to see when these young boys come out of Bankshire Hill and they see their peers being taken seriously, when they see them standing in front of a room of 100 people or dancing or co-facilitating a leadership workshop, you've just got no idea, you know, what kind of hope that inspires in some of those young people that have just never seen that before.
Yes, I'm sure that would have an effect in the community. And you mentioned dancing then. Is the Aboriginal culture part of what you promote in this program?
Yeah, that is central to everything that we do. And you might be thinking, well, you know, what would a white woman know about that? Well, you know, I can only draw on what I see. And when we've got 15 young men actually going back to country next week, we have a cultural partner called Eugene Eads down at Now and Up Farm at Now Anger Up, and we're probably both similar in that we're very visionary and we've got all these ideas, but we're also completely different at the same time. And he's very good at what he does down there. And he takes the boys, he takes them back in time. And they get an opportunity to go back and reconnect with their culture. They trace their family trees. He gets them to work on what he calls a cultural toolkit. And in that cultural toolkit, they make different things to go into the toolkit, but they all represent something, like one will represent resilience or one will represent, you know, a strength that they might need to draw on when they're going through a challenging time. So it's a completely different little world down there, but it's extremely powerful, the country that they're actually working on as well. But dance, you just mentioned that's significant. The boys are always being called out and booked to do dances. And I think the thing that's a bit different with their dances is that they bring stories with them. And throughout the dances, they'll share some of their life stories and their journeys at the same time. And it's really, it's very inspiring, and it's pretty different to anything that you've ever seen.
Look, I'm sure it is, and look, we're hoping we might be able to speak to Eugene perhaps in another show.
I'd be
very interested to talk to him too.
He's magnificent. He's just a ray of sunshine, that man. And he's one of a kind. The boys, we had two of our leaders went down for 10 days just recently to recharge their batteries, and when they came back, they said, "Oh, Leanne, he's just gold, that man. He's just everything. His knowledge, culture, joy, fun, everything all rolled into one. There's just not many of him around."
Yes, because I guess we were talking before that it's not always easy, but there has to be, I'm sure there has to be an element of fun in it to get them involved.
There's never a dull moment, I tell you. I mean, I'm just almost busting just thinking about it, you know. These guys are just hilarious. Mm. You know, we have so much fun as well. They keep you young, that's for sure, you know. But oh, the stories, I mean, there's a lot of tears and heartache as well, but geez, there's a lot of hilarious stories. You know, they reminisce even, I mean, these guys have spent time locked up, obviously, but some funny things happen in there too, you know, and sometimes they share that stuff, and it's very funny.
Yeah, very moving. Now, Halo's been around for about 4 years, but I think the journey's been going longer than that, hasn't it?
Yeah. Look, the only way really to work with Aboriginal people, you've got to have had some sort of connection or relationship, you know, somewhere along the line. And, you know, I moved into South Lake about, 15 years ago now. I can't believe it's that long. But that's where it all started, moving into that suburb, getting to know the families. And we used to run discos and movie nights once a month, and that's sort of where I started to meet all the kids and families. That was just a volunteer thing at a local church, you know. And then I started working in the justice system as a youth worker, and a lot of the young boys were sort of getting in contact with the justice system, and so then you start to get to meet the families even more. But Halo came about because things needed to be done differently. And Judge Reynolds, the president of the Children's Court, who's one of our biggest fans, I mean, he's the first to say that, and he says it publicly all the time. Things have got to be done differently. And what needs to be done, it's really not rocket science. And if the taxpayers actually knew how much money got wasted on, you know, detention and other programs, they'd really start warming more to the kind of work that we do. It's not just about doing what's right, it's actually about doing what's right financially for taxpayers as well. But, you know, I mean, the people in the community really do have the answers to their own issues. They just need to convince those with the power and the funds to listen to them and provide that wraparound support to make it happen. And that's really what we've done.
Yes, I've seen some figures that to incarcerate a juvenile costs something like $190,000 a year, whereas you can do it for a lot less, I believe.
Well, you know, I mean, we were just saying the other day, I'd like to do some sort of, not a demonstration, but something visually where people get to see. You know, we did a sea of hands, this beautiful sea of hands for Sorry Day, and they're hands, and they've got like a wire on them, and you put them in the ground, and they represent different things. And I was saying, if we went back and got all those sea of hands and we put 400 in the ground, that's 400 that represent 400 juveniles that are locked up, times that by 200,000, and that's how much it costs to keep all those 400 young men locked up every year.
Mm.
You take out one of those hands, and that's how much it costs to run our program for a whole year. Now, that's just imagine that comparison. You know, 400 times 200,000. Just give us one of those hands, and we could keep this program running on a 12 monthly basis.
Well, that's true, and I think fortunately you have had some government funding recently, haven't you?
Yeah, it's sort of semi-government. The government launched the Healing Foundation this year, and they handed the committee over to the Stolen Generation. So they actually got to choose who they wanted to give some funds to, and everybody had to apply. And we were fortunate enough to get $120,000, which wasn't... We actually applied for $280,000, so we need to try and come up with that gap. Otherwise, we're going to have to, you know, cut a lot out of the program, which we don't really want to do. But $120,000 will keep us going for about 6 months. And then we're sort of back to the drawing board again. But that 6 months will give 20 young people an opportunity to access the program, and also four trips back to country, which is really significant.
Yes. And do you get funding from the community as well?
The program was piloted a couple of years ago, and we got the funding from Lottery West. Mm-hmm. So that funding actually runs out in March next year. But as you mentioned, I sort of seed funded the program, and I think with the Lottery West funding, nobody had any idea just how successful it would be. It's benchmarking, and it's been called one of the most successful programs in Australia. And I must say, another program, the Yiriman Project up north, we met with them recently, and they're doing fantastic work. But I think you've got the Yiriman Project up north, and you've got HALO sort of down here in the metro area, and they seem to be the two programs that are attracting a lot of attention at the moment.
Yeah, look, that's great, and all the publicity is all going to help, I'm sure, if people know what you're doing.
Well, I think, you know, if people... I guess the message that I would like to get across as well is that, you know, I was recently told by a politician that, oh, Leanne, you can't, you know, we know best about how to approach the issue, because the public won't like it if they find out, you know, we're going soft on crime. And I just said, my response was, I don't even want to hear that phrase, soft on crime. If I understand if people do something wrong, there's a punishment, and that needs to be looked at. And I'm not even going there. We're not about, you know, if you do the crime, you do the time. Okay, if we have to live with that, we have to live with it. But what I'm saying is, and I'm at Banksia Hill this morning delivering a program in the detention centre, if you could sit in there for a couple of hours, honestly, and listen to the stories about what those kids have been through, from 0 to 16, they would draw at your heartstrings, there's no doubt about it. They've been through so much more than anybody should ever have to deal with. And there's a huge majority of those that are also wards of the state. So, you know, the government had a responsibility to look after them, because they took on their parental rights, they took on that responsibility, and they're still locked up. But at the end of that, it's not all doom and gloom. At the end of that, those young men, they put these life plans together, and they say at the end of it, they have dreams. They say, I want to be a taxi driver, or I want to be a mechanic, or, you know, they've got goals, and they don't... None of those goals include going back to detention. I've never met anybody that said, I need a warm bed or I need to be in jail. I've never, ever heard that, so I don't know where that comes from. But if we could inject some funds into that last stage to help those kids fulfil those goals, those dreams, they wouldn't go back into detention. So, you know, I think that if the public were aware of that and they knew that these kids... They're not hardcore criminals. You know, they've had huge challenges in life. They've used drugs, and that's usually why they're there. But at the end of the day, they do have goals and dreams, and they really need just that little bit of support to stay out of the system. Then, you know, we could transform the justice system, no doubt about it.
Yes, well, you are an inspiration, Leanne, and I know you previously had a career at a stockbroking firm, I believe, to take up this work.
Yep.
And having immersed yourself now, I guess, in the Aboriginal culture, what do you see as the differences between that, say, dealing with the Aboriginals in this situation to perhaps the white boys who are in this situation? Do you see any major differences there?
Yep, I tell you, there's some good things and some challenges that these kids deal with. You know, I mean, almost brings tears to my eyes when I think about the Aboriginal culture and those Aboriginal. They would. It's the people that have the least that will give the most. These kids and their families are the most generous, you know, people that you'll ever meet, and that's something that's, and they're loyal, and you know, that really sticks in my mind. In terms of nobody likes to use the racism word, and it's something that I don't like to throw around, but it's something that's out there and it's underlying and people don't even realise. And I'll give you an example. I was in a restaurant just a few weeks ago with my sister that was here on holidays, and there was a young man that was from a project up north who works for a university and travels the world, been to Venice, been everywhere, you know, curator, art, amazing young man. And he was just down for some work that we'd been doing, and we were having dinner, and I said, "Oh, look, there's so-and-so," and I yelled out, "Oh, hi," and he came and sat with us, and we sat down, and we talked for about an hour, and he met my sister, and, you know, it was great. But afterwards, the waitress came up to me, and she said, "I'm just coming over to make sure everything's okay at this table." And I looked at her, and I said, "What do you mean by that?" And she said, "Oh, well, you know, sometimes we get people that just walk in off the street, and I just wanted to make sure everything was okay here." Now, well, I knew immediately where that was coming from, and I asked her the question, and I said, "Oh, are you referring to our work colleague? Oh, you know, would you have actually asked me that question if he was white?" And I mean, I know that's a confronting question to ask, but the reality was it was the truth.
Yes.
Now, she said, well, and she got annoyed and said, "Oh, I was only trying to take care of you." Mm. Now, she probably meant well, but the point is, these are the challenges that these young Aboriginal men face on a daily basis, and people just aren't aware of it.
Yes, and look, I completely agree with you. I think it has to be confronted whenever you see it. I think the language has to be confronted.
Yeah.
You know, we all sit around and hear people talking in a derogatory manner about the Aboriginal people. I think you've got to put your hand up. So,
yeah. The thing is, too, this is just a side issue, but one of the challenges for us down here is jobs. And our young men come through this program, they work so hard on their issues, and they're ready for work, and there's not a lot of work around.
Mm.
So I'm not too sure where all these jobs are that are supposed to be being created for, you know, for Aboriginal young people or Aboriginal people in general, and the mining jobs as well in WA. If there is any mining company listening that wants some great staff, please call me, because we're having real challenges trying to get these kids into the mining industry. So I'm not too sure what's going on there, but and we work really closely with the job network agencies that are funded federally to find jobs, and we're struggling to come up with the employment.
Mm, and you don't know what the barrier is.
There's no real barrier there. There just doesn't seem to be the jobs available. Mm.
Yes, well, look, I was in Darwin a few years ago, and it just amazed me that there were no black faces serving behind the counters.
Mm.
So, I mean, there might be the jobs, and maybe there is still some unseen discrimination going on.
Mm.
But, yes, I know Twiggy Forrest, I think, Andrew Forrest, I think, has been running a program trying to get Aboriginals into the workforce. I don't know whether you've had any involvement with him.
I mean, I could be wrong, but I know that he works up north, you know, so they concentrate on employing Aboriginal young people from the communities that they're mining in.
Yes.
So I'm not so sure how much benefit that's going to have for the metropolitan young men. And I think for us, that's a point needs to be raised, is that Noongar, the Noongar culture, Noongar Noongars in Perth. They're the biggest. That's the biggest. They've got the largest amount of numbers, but they're the ones that seem to be getting left out.
Mm.
So up north, there's opportunities being created, but we mustn't forget though. You know, those in the southwest, and also those in the metropolitan area. They've got quiet voices,
yes.
But we have a huge amount of Aboriginal young people living in the Perth metropolitan area that are missing out on opportunities as well.
Yes, and you mentioned those quiet voices. Is it a cultural thing with Aboriginals that they tend not to push themselves forward and not to to be gung-ho for these jobs that others might do?
Well, I think there's a difference here. People always say you can tell a young person that's been through a HALO program because they're very confident. There's no holding back once you've come through this program. And, you know, I think they bring an enormous amount of... they bring so much to the workplace. We had a rally a little while ago and we had about 200 people there, and, you know, if you're given a space and an opportunity to have a voice, certainly people will come forward.
Mm. If someone were assigned from the court to you, what would they expect? How would it progress from when you first meet that person?
Yep, so usually young people self-refer, so everybody's here because they want to be here, and that there's a significant difference there. And usually it's not necessarily a referral through the court. It's usually a young person that'll go to their justice officer and say, I've heard about HALO or I've met HALO while I was locked up, I want to go to that program, and that's generally how it works. We haven't really had to take any mandated referrals because everybody wants to be here,
mm.
and that makes a big difference.
Yes.
But once you come here, you're here 4 days a week, and you work on a Certificate 2 in Community Services, and the reason that we chose that is because you've got to have some sort of education involved. That gives you an opportunity to work on not only your own issues, but to learn how to provide support to others, and that's a significant factor here, is when you walk through the doors, it's no longer just about you anymore. It's about not only working on your issues, but supporting those around you. I mean, you know, being on drugs is a very selfish, it's a selfish way of living because it's all about you. And there's reasons for that. So there's a shift once you come here. It's not just about you anymore. It's about the rest of the world and everybody else around you as well. And I think that's what makes this program a bit different. But also, we have a strong sporting component. We have basketball teams that play in a midweek competition on a Tuesday night. We have a football team that's won the grand final.
Yes, congratulations on that. That was a great win.
Well, you know, the football's been magnificent because last year we had one young person play mainstream football, and this year we had 19 transition into mainstream clubs, into club footy. And that's what that's done, is open up a whole new social network for these boys. And we had coaches that had our young men in their backyards for barbecues and, you know, end of season celebrations. And now they've got all these wonderful new supports around them, which, you know, that's magnificent because we can't be there all the time. But, yeah, the sport's been significant. The guys do a lot of public speaking. So microphone, sharing stories, inspiring others, opening conferences, and that's been a huge, that's been hugely successful because not only now are they, you know, making big changes for themselves, but their opinions are being taken seriously and other people are being inspired by them as well.
Yes, look, that's all great stuff, and it's really, I think, a more general application because boys have to grow into men, and I think that's happening in the whole community. They're missing out on those sorts of opportunities, and therefore they stay boys.
Yeah, well, it's exciting here because we've had three young men transition now out into, they've got their own homes, and it's like, oh, wow, you know, that's the next thing now. So it's lovely seeing them moving into their own homes and getting a car and, you know, doing all the things that you're supposed to do in life, getting a loan, you know, from a bank, and just it's just magnificent to see them turning into these wonderful, strong men that are going to be great dads and role models for their kids. And I tell you what, it gives me such hope for the next generation.
Look, that's great. And we're speaking with Leanne Smith, who's the founder and CEO of HALO. which operates in Western Australia. Leanne, I think, we're running out of time, but thank you very much for coming on the program. And if people want to find out more about HALO, is there a website they can go to?
Yeah, they can go to www.haloleadership.com.au.
That's great. And if anyone wants to assist with the funding and all the wonderful work that Leanne and her fellow workers are doing, they can go to that website and get information there, I'm sure.
Absolutely. It'll be the most rewarding experience they've ever had.
I'm sure it will be. Look, it's great news, Leanne. And look, thank you very much for coming on the show. And we can only wish you all the best for your continuing work with the young Aboriginal community.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Leanne.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
In Distress, meeting your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air. We're getting towards the end of today's show on the 26th of October. I'd like to particularly thank Greg Andresen, who did the interview with Warren Farrell a little earlier. And Dr. Warren Farrell, for people who would like some more information or would like to follow up on the work he's doing, he is the author of Father and Child Reunion, which was mentioned in the interview. And his other books include Myth of Male Power, Women Can't Hear What Men Don't Say, and Why Men Are the Way They Are. These books are sold in more than 50 countries in 10 languages, and Warren Farrell is definitely a leader in this field. So thank you, Greg, for organising that. Warren is going to be featuring more as we get closer to International Men's Day, and I think there's going to be we'll have available an extended interview with Warren. He'll be telling us a lot more about the International Men's Day and some of the activities that are going on and his own work in this area. We'd also like to particularly thank Leanne Smith from HALO in Western Australia, and it was inspirational to hear the work she's doing with the mainly Aboriginal young people in that age range of 14 to 22. And so getting these people out of the court systems is definitely the way to go, and we can only hope she gets some more funding, both from government and from others in the community. So that was it was great to talk to Leanne. Next week we will be having more to say about the Movember and International Men's Day, and we're looking forward to another big show. So until next week, remember you can listen to the show again if you go to our website, www.dadsontheair.net. And in the meantime, from us at Dads on the Air, from Bill Cable, Ian Purdy, Phil York, we say all the best, and we'll look forward to seeing you next week.
We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.